as well. Well, thanks very much to Paul Brand. Thank you very much indeed to Camilla Tominey as well from the Daily Telegraph. Next on the programme, we're going to talk about Baby Reindeer, this Netflix series which has become very popular and very controversial. Katie, we've talked about this several times on the media show, and there's a good reason for that.
Well, there is. I mean, plenty of people won't have seen the programme, but there is actually a wider question for us all, because there are rules for traditional broadcasters when it comes to how real people are treated. But with the advent of the streamers and the fragmentation of the media, the law, the guidance looks like it's playing catch up. So, you know, questions around, can the streamers now write stories about any of us and claim that it's a true story and there's nothing we can do about it? And of course, it throws up other ethical questions, you know, one person's right to tell their story against another person's right to privacy. You know, is it right to thrust a vulnerable person into the spotlight without attempting to protect their identity?
So that is why we're coming back to it again. If you haven't watched the series, Baby Reindeer tells the story of how the Scottish comedian Richard Gadd was stalked and harassed by a woman after serving her in a pub. His stalker, named Martha in the series, allegedly sent him more than 41,000 emails and left 350 hours of voicemails on his phone. She also turns up at his home and workplace in the series. This is a clip of the programme.
Every day now, Martha would be outside, this ticking time bomb on my life. I would leave first thing in the morning and she would be there.
I love you, Nipple. Think of me at work today.
Now, in the opening sequence of the first episode of Baby Reindeer, we're told this is a true story. At the end of the series and the end credits of each edition, the programme says it's based on real events. However, certain characters' names, incidents, locations and dialogue have been fictionalised for dramatic purposes. And now, Katie, we have a further development in the story.
We do, because Fiona Harvey, she's the woman who alleges that she's the inspiration for the stalker character Martha in the Netflix drama. She's suing Netflix for defamation, negligence and privacy violations. And that court document was filed just at the end of last week. She claims that she was falsely depicted as a convicted criminal who spent her time in prison for stalking. And she's calling the claims that the story is true the biggest lie in TV history. That's in the court filing. And it's got an American spin to it, that filing. There's no understatement in that whatsoever in its many pages. Her lawsuit was filed in California and she is seeking $170 million in damages. And Netflix, it's important to say, first of all, has never said that Fiona Harvey is indeed the inspiration for Martha, but it's also said it will defend this matter vigorously and will stand by the right of the show's creator, Richard Gadd, to tell his story. So I suppose the question we want to ask today is, does Fiona Harvey have a case? And I want to look at that first from a US law perspective. And we're joined by Stuart Benjamin, who is Professor of Law at Duke University. Stuart, thank you so much for coming on the media show. I wonder if you could just start with what Fiona Harvey is actually alleging in this lawsuit.
Sure. So her first and most important claim is a defamation claim, that they made false statements about her that injured her reputation. She made additional claims that might be less likely to win: intentional infliction of emotional distress, negligence, and violation of her right of publicity. I think my assumption, most people's assumption, is that the claim that she would be most likely to win on, as I suggested, is the defamation claim.
And why is that? I mean, does she have a greater chance of winning a defamation case in the US than she does in the UK? Because, as I said, this was filed in the US.
No. Oh, no, no. UK law is much tougher on defamation plaintiffs. So in particular, in the US, she has to prove the falsity of the factual claims made about her. In the UK, Netflix would have to prove the truth of the claims about her. That's important because some of the claims are going to be hard to prove either way. How is anybody going to prove that she sat outside 16 hours a day watching him walk in and walk out of his place of work? She has to prove that's false in the US. And so that is a higher burden for her. You might wonder then, why is she bringing the lawsuit?
Well, that's exactly what I was going to ask. Why is she not doing it in the UK?
So as we noted, it's about deeper pockets. So Richard Gadd, probably there's a limited amount. She can't sue him for $170 million, and she can sue Netflix. And so she needs to sue Netflix in the U.S. That's where they're located, in order to get, frankly, the bigger outcome for her.
And if that disclaimer that Roz was talking about that is at the end of the programme, does that help Netflix's case at all, do you think?
Absolutely, it helps. Having said that, because they said at the beginning, this is a true story, and not just there, but also on their website, repeatedly they say it's a true story. And SNP MP John Nicholson was told by a Netflix executive, this is a true story. A jury might easily say, we think that disclaimer doesn't fully undercut the degree to which you are making a factual claim.
It's also worth saying that disclaimer comes up right at the end after all the credits, and I'm not sure how many people stick to the very end of that.
Right. And just more generally, you know, you could imagine a situation in which I say repeatedly, what I'm about to tell you is true, what I'm about to tell you is true, and then I say something. And then at the end, I say, well, maybe it's not true. You can imagine a jury saying, well, those opening statements are so strong, we think you're in fact making a factual claim.
And what about if there's some truth in it? If she didn't send 41,000 emails, but they proved she sent 10,000, does magnitude matter? Does it have to be wholly true?
So interestingly, the answer is if it's false, then she still can claim it's false. But she doesn't mention any of that in her complaint. Her complaint is focused in particular that she was a convicted stalker who served a 4.5-year sentence, and that she then pled guilty in the Richard Gadd case and was sentenced to a nine-month sentence. So she's really focused on those factual claims. She has actually not talked about all of the things that got all the press, the many hours of voicemails, et cetera. She doesn't have to.
And what about, I mean, I've been covering this story a lot, so I'm slightly in the weeds on this, but people might remember Fiona Harvey did an interview on the Piers Morgan show and told her side of the story. Does that make a difference to the court case? Was that a mistake, do you think?
So we have our laws are guided by the First Amendment, and the Supreme Court has held that if you are a public figure, if you have injected yourself into some controversy, then the standard for you is higher in order to win a defamation case. You have to prove that the person who said the false statement either knew that it was false or was reckless about its falsity. I think that she has a strong argument here that she has not injected herself into any debate, that she was brought into this by many people on the internet who discovered who she was, and that the interview was just part and parcel of the lawsuit that she is bringing.
Okay, and
if it was decided otherwise, then it's not clear who would be a private figure. I mean, does it mean any time then you bring a lawsuit and you go do an interview about the lawsuit, you become a public figure, then we'd all be public figures?
And we're talking about eye-watering sums. She's wanting $170 million. How realistic is that? Is that a typical amount asked for in a defamation case in California?
In the U.S., the answer is yes, sure. Why not ask for a lot of money? Let me just tell you, these cases generally settle. And so you are trying to anchor with a high opening bid, in effect, on the settlement negotiations. Having said that, Netflix would not be likely to settle if they thought she had no case whatsoever. But they did say repeatedly, this is a true story, and that does give her additional ammunition.
Professor Benjamin, thank you very much indeed for giving us that U.S. legal perspective. Now let's get a U.K. legal perspective. Persephone Bridgman-Baker is partner at the law firm Carter Ruck. Thank you very much indeed for joining us here in the studio. If this had been brought in the UK, do you think a case could have been made?
I think the most important thing from the UK perspective in comparison to the US perspective is the amount of damages which one would be able to seek. I mean, this is way over and above what you would even be able to put down on your claim for this sort in the UK. And I think that's probably driven the decision to bring it in the US.
So what could you put in the UK?
So in the UK, damages for defamation are pinned to the damages that you would expect for personal injury claims. So you might expect in the low hundreds of thousands maximum. Really for a defamation claim in the UK courts. And of course, our defamation claims are now overseen by a judge alone. I think that possibly may have been an influencing factor here because juries are known to be more sympathetic to human stories. Having said that, that could go either way in this case, of course, because you have two individuals, both of whom have their idiosyncrasies, and who knows which way a jury might turn on that. But in relation to the differences in our standards of proof, for example, as referenced by Stuart, I think the points that he makes all stand. Here you would have to show that the story was substantially true, and you referred to that when you asked about whether or not you have to get the exact numbers of emails right. I think here it would be difficult to say that if you have stalked somebody, if that can be demonstrated that she has in fact done that, whether it's in exactly the way that's replicated in the show, I still think that there would be a possibility that that Netflix would be able to defend the claim here.
Are there precedents for this kind of defamation case where someone feels like a drama or a series which is based on a true story is clearly referencing them and not referencing them in an accurate way?
So there are a few such claims against Netflix, dating back to sort of, the time during which this true genre of series has become more popular. So in 2020, there was a claim against Netflix in the US over the Central Park 5 drama, which was called When They See Us. That was settled. In 2022, there was a claim about the Queen's Gambit against Netflix, and that was settled. And currently, Netflix are defending a claim about the show Inventing Anna. And my understanding is that Netflix have applied to strike that claim out as being groundless, and a decision has just been made by the US courts that the claimant can continue with that case. So Netflix has lost that interim hearing.
And Stuart, if I could bring you in on these previous cases that Persephone is referencing, is it the case that a jury considering one claim such as this would be asked to consider previous claims which have been brought?
So they could. Netflix's lawyers will clearly try to argue that that's irrelevant. It's more prejudicial than probative is the term that's often used. But yes, absolutely. You would want to say this is a consistent pattern with Netflix. They lie without remorse. And this is related to her claim for punitive damages. So again, a difference between us and the UK. She is asking for more than $40 million in punitive damages. That would be designed to stop a wrongdoer who has done something that a pattern of behavior that is so egregious that the system needs to punish that person to stop that pattern.
Persephone, do we have punitive damages in the UK?
So you can obtain aggravated damages. I think the doubling down by Netflix on this, I think, is potentially problematic. So the fact that they have repeated that it's a true story, and indeed one of their senior executives was before a parliamentary select committee repeating that this is not only a true story, but also that she is a convicted stalker. And so that might play into an aggravated damages type claim.
And I'm interested in the words that producers, Netflix in this case, put on screen. We've mentioned at the beginning of Baby Reindeer, it says this is a true story. Every Inventing Anna episode began with these words: this whole story is completely true, except for the parts that are completely made up. Persephone, does that help if you put words like that at the front?
I think that being at the forefront does help. It's unusual, Baby Reindeer, in that regard. Saying this is a true story up front, I think, might be the death nail for Netflix in this case.
Baby Reindeer is unusual. It's also incredibly popular. It's one of Netflix's most watched shows of all time now. So I suppose the question is all publicity good publicity? And we're joined by Hannah Bowler, who's senior reporter at the marketing industry magazine The Drum, because we want to have a quick look at how this controversy could affect the bottom line. Hannah, how are you seeing this? Do you think Netflix is viewing this controversy with completely kind of gloom-filled spectacles, if you can have gloom-filled spectacles, or is it more complicated than that? They've certainly had a lot of publicity out of this furore.
Yeah, I would say it's definitely a sort of brand of Netflix to run sort of riskier content and storytelling tactics. I think it's definitely within that sort of remit and storytelling to sort of run pieces like this, and that's what brings people to Netflix. It's definitely sort of on their brand. The question of whether they sort of they're looking for this type of controversy in order to generate more views, or you know, all publicity is good publicity, a little bit more on the fence about, I guess yeah, it's definitely an interesting one if they were trying to use it as a way of marketing the show itself.
Yeah, I suppose that's the question. You know, what is their typical marketing strategy for TV drama? Would it be a stretch to say, you know, that this one, you know, you don't put that much money in at the beginning, but then a controversy like this, you know, lights up the internet and suddenly everybody wants to watch Baby Reindeer?
Well, firstly, they did use some advertising for Baby Reindeer at the beginning. They used a lot of out of home. They've done a sort of big glitzy screening in LA. So there was advertising before the show on this case. But I'd say it's kind of reflective of Netflix's strategy in terms of sort of not pumping loads of money into the front end of the launch of the show and letting it sort of spread by word of mouth.
And just to clarify, what do you mean by out-of-home advertising?
Sorry, that's billboards on the street. I use some marketing lingo there.
You're run-of-the-mill advertising. Okay, great, we get that.
Yeah. On bus stops.
So they do a bit of that. I mean, I did hear that in LA, where Baby Reindeer is hoping to win some Emmys, I think there's already, I hear, quite a lot of billboards up on the LA streets of advertising Baby Reindeer. I'd like to bring in Scott Bryan here, a TV critic, host of the must-watch podcast on BBC Five Live and BBC Sounds. Hello, Scott.
Hi.
Hi. What's your take on the Baby Reindeer saga?
I mean, when I first saw this drama, I thought it was incredibly compelling, and it continues the sort of trend we've seen when it's been like sort of someone's story, but they are in front of the camera as well as behind the camera. Of course, we've had like Fleabag, we've had Michaela Cole's I May Destroy You as well. And there's an added edge when you see these sort of dramas, because you really feel that there is a message that's clear from the creator that radiates through. But I mean, as we've seen, it's felt like this has been a runaway train. No one knows where it's going to end up. And it also, I think, at times risks the sort of the media buzz around the show eclipsing the initial success of the show to maybe Netflix's detriment. Because Netflix wants the conversation to be about the TV programme, and it's just not really ending up like that anymore.
Hey, Hannah, could I just ask you, do you think it's possible to manufacture a water cooler moment anymore in our fragmented media landscape?
No, I would say a lot more goes on behind the scenes in terms of marketing spend. I think traditionally there's been this sort of narrative that Netflix doesn't put a lot of money behind the marketing of its shows. I would say in recent years that's kind of changed, and actually we see them as a pretty big advertiser. A lot of the ad agencies we speak to have Netflix as pretty major clients. So I would say that old sort of narrative of not plugging too much money into their shows is not quite the same as it used to be.
Hannah, for the moment, thank you very much indeed. Scott, thanks too for your thoughts on Baby Reindeer. We're going to leave Baby Reindeer for one moment, because between now and the end of the programme, we're going to turn to the evolution of reality TV, both talking about the kinds of formats that are getting made, but also where we watch reality TV. A couple of things to mention. The 11th series of Love Island launched last Monday, and we could consider that a legacy TV franchise, if you like. It's broadcasting on, of course, ITV, and it's being watched primarily either on demand or on linear TV. But it's facing increasingly stiff competition online. In the case of YouTube, that is primarily where this competition is coming from. For example, the hugely popular British creators The Sidemen have now launched their own reality TV show, where 10 influencers are locked in a house for a week to battle for a prize worth up to £1 million. Let's hear a little bit of it.
Welcome to Inside,
the Sidemen's first ever reality show.
One house, 7 days.
10 contestants.
I make pause though. Please step aside so they can see me in the...
All battling it out for £1 million.
The only catch?
We've taken absolutely everything from them.
Scott, do you like the sound of that?
I mean, I think being trapped in a house full of influencers is not really my bag.
What about watching people trapped in a house with a lot of influencers?
Well, I have seen this show, and I think it's got merits. I mean, I think that the thing I find impressive is that if you are an internet creator and you've built a considerable fan base, if you then have meetings with the likes of BBC, ITV, Channel 4, Netflix, it's about a year until the TV show then gets made, because you then got to go through all the meetings, you then got to cast it, you then got to go and sort of film it and edit it. I don't know how much lead time they had with this Sidemen show, but there's something about the internet that means that the turnover is far, far quicker. You don't have to ask permission. You don't really even have to deal with Ofcom regulations, because it's inherently an internet show. So that means that whilst it might not be as polished as a show that is on ITV2 at 9 p.m. You could end up having something that is incredibly internet-based and has an instant reaction. And also for Sidemen, like they did a big charity event at the London Olympic Park in the stadium that was a bit like Soccer Aid. It was raising money for a different charity, but it had the production quality of an ITV broadcast. I was really blown away by just the skill of it. So it's always upping itself in the ante.
Just quickly, Scott, who are they?
I mean, they are a sort of a set of friends who have just, over the course of 10 years, has built a big online sort of following by just being themselves, doing challenges, reaction videos, and knowing exactly how to market themselves. I think it's there was certainly a generation of creators who don't really need TV now to be famous.
And I have to say, I'm going to sound like an old lady now, but the only time my son has properly loved me is when I managed to get him tickets to the Sidemen charity football match.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that was like good, you know, tick for mum. I mean, we're talking here about reality TV. I mean, one new format is the BBC reality show I Kissed a Girl, which finished its series recently. And Sophie Wilkinson is a freelance journalist and, I think, Sophie, a fan of I Kissed a Girl.
Yes, absolutely. I'm so pleased we've come to that.
Just tell me, it's, you know, as Roz was talking about, Love Island began its 11th series last Monday, but lesbian viewers like you have been singing the praises of this show. It's a dating show for queer women. Is that actually more radical than it sounds?
I think what's so radical about it is that the BBC take on the Love Island format is so much more kind. There's a lot of care around the contestants. I'm sure there were plenty of opportunities to bait them and to put them in situations that could have been exploitative, but instead it's a lot more kind and soft and gentle, and there's clearly some moments where they've been prompted to talk about issues. You know, let's all talk about, you know, why the L is at the front of LGBT. Let's all talk about, you know, homophobia in the community. Let's all talk about what it's like to be bisexual. You know, there's these clear moments that are really designed, you know, to fulfill the education portion of what the BBC is out to do. And it just made it so much more fun. Now, I am in a bubble of lesbians who are absolutely obsessed with the show. We're very, very interested as well in like the after show as well. After the reunion show, a few bombshells were dropped, and I don't want to give any spoilers, but a huge set of bombshells were dropped. And now watching that all play out on social media, now they're all allowed to talk about what happened in the 6 months or 8 months since filming, is very, very intriguing. But the bubble that I'm in is very, very obsessed with it. And as much as I can't, you know, we haven't necessarily seen the viewing figures yet. I think they're coming out in a few weeks' time. But although we can't see the impact in that way, what I know is that it gives a lot of lesbians a lot of confidence just to see ourselves represented on screen, to have a laugh about it, to talk about it with each other on WhatsApp. It's a really, really wonderful way of us all coming together.
Because I was going to say, sometimes TV programmes feel revolutionary and you think, how can it be revolutionary now to make this programme? And yet it is. Did you put that programme in that category?
I mean, There's only a couple of characters who I would, characters, they're real people, but there's only a few people that I think are living quite radically queer lives. And I think like Amy and Thea in particular are very, very kind of engaging in that way. And a lot of the other stories that kind of play out, cause as it is a, you know, a reality show, it's, you know, there are some confected elements.
But the fact is, a lesbian dating show is that revolutionary in itself?
It's a shame, but yeah, it is. And I mean, there was Tila Tequila, A Shot at Love, which was a bisexual dating show. But that, you know, that was considered this weird, strange thing that was at a remove from what normal people did. And actually, what's so engaging about this is that there are so many normal seeming couples in it, just really normal, average people.
And it is worth saying it's Pride Month next week. It's Pride Month now.
Right now.
Last weekend, there was also a milestone on Doctor Who, the first gay kiss featuring the Doctor, Chuti Gatwa. Scott, I just wonder if you could reflect on both I Kissed a Girl and what's happened in Doctor Who in terms of how you see these programmes.
I mean, I just think it has such an impact on particularly young viewers who are watching, because I think of myself when I was younger watching these programmes. I remember 20 years ago in Corrie, there was a same-sex kiss between two characters, which happened to be the very first day I came out. But that in the media was portrayed as, I think in the Daily Express the next day, they had a headline, Night of Shame. And that made me feel that my life was somehow debatable and controversial, and I didn't have any public affection with a guy for the next sort of 5 years, no hand-holding, no kissing. And I think if you have this everyday experience of LGBTQ plus lives, which are, by the way, made by a lot of LGBTQ plus people trying to represent their lives behind the camera too. It has such an impact. You won't see it straight away. You'll see it in about 5, 10, 15 years when the next generation comes through. Trust me, it will have a big impact.
I'm afraid, Scott, and everyone else, we are out of time. Thank you very much indeed to all of you for joining us. Thanks to Scott Bryan and to Sophie Wilkinson.
Also thanks to Paul Brand from ITV News, Camilla Tominey from the Daily Telegraph, and Professor Dominic Ring from Loughborough University.
And to Stuart Benjamin from Duke University, Persephone Bridgman-Baker from the law firm Carter Ruck, and Hannah Bowler from The Drum.
And a quick mention that you can watch the media show on BBC iPlayer and listen back on BBC Sounds. But that is it for now. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.